Okay, thank you for telling me and thank you for having me here. My name is Mehrnush Esaghian-Wilner. I'm a professor of engineering practice over at the Electrical Engineering Department at the University of Southern California. The title of my talk today is Body Networks. This gives an overview of some of the work which is done in the field, and we try to focus on some of the projects that my team and I are working on at USC on this topic. Okay, so let's start with the outline of the talk. So I will start with an introduction to what I mean by body networks, definition of which is, so I'll start with giving you an introduction to body networks, which is slightly different than what you may have seen. It's a more enhanced version of what is known as body area networks. I will, after defining it, I will concentrate and give you an overview of three main types of devices that is used, namely wearable devices, implantable devices, and non-invasive devices that could be part of this network. Next, I'll talk about network integration of all these devices and some of the networking issues. And next, I will move into legal, ethical, and security issues with this new type of technology. And at the end, we'll try to conclude with giving you a summary and some of our opinions about some of the open areas that are available in this area for further investigation. Okay, so next slide, please. So introduction to body networks is network of devices which are both local to and inside of the body. So you have devices that are inside or local or close by to the body, and they're all in some form of communication, and they're used for monitoring, diagnosis, and treatment of devices. These devices may be monitored and controlled externally. They could be made up of different types of devices that could be worn on the body. They could be surgically implanted or introduced non-invasively, as we will talk about and we say how that could be done. The main source for this talk is actually my brand new book, which is going to be published very shortly this year by John Wiley and Sons. The title of the book is Wireless Computing in Medicine, From Nano to Cloud with Ethical and Legal Implications. This is an edited volume. It contains 21 chapters. It brings together a large group of international scientists who all specialize in this field. Okay, next slide, please. Having talked about giving you an introduction, I'm going to talk about the first type of these devices, and that's the wearable devices. In the next slide. So wearable devices is actually kind of devices that I assume many of you are familiar with. They're worn on or kept on the body. They're easily added or they're removed. And there are two main kinds of these devices in two categories. One category is the category of medical devices. These are the devices that are specifically designed to work for medical applications. On the other hand, the other category is general devices. These are devices that are not specifically designed to be medical devices. However, they are being used as such. Examples of medical devices we'll go over very quickly are like life alert, insulin pump, and examples of general devices are things such as Google Glass, Apple Watch, and Fitbit. So let's look at them quickly on the next slide. So as part of wearable devices under the medical category, examples is life alert, which you assume would be familiar with. It alerts the paramedics when a button is pressed. And another kind is insulin pumps. It regulates insulin levels and it makes corrective injections whenever is appropriate. Now, on the next slide, we're talking about wearable devices that are general. They're not necessarily made for medical applications. However, they're used as such. One of them are your regular cell phones. They're kept on the body. The person carries them. They're actually computers, smart computers. They're computing devices. And they're used for things such as sensing activity and behavioral data. They coordinate and communicate between other devices, and they have a lot of other uses as well. Let's look at some example. One of those examples is the incense in the next view graph. On the right, I've kind of given a little bit of a flow chart about how it works technically. This appears more in detail in my book, Chapter 5. This is the work of some of my colleagues, Professor Castro, Favila, Chavez, Perez, Rodriguez. And what this does is that it has simple monitoring capabilities. They have been two applications that have been presented on this. One of them is for monitoring people with disruptive behaviors in Alzheimer's disease, and the other one is for people who fall. So the example that I have on the right side, instead of going into the details of it, what I can tell you is that basically it's trying to sense the data. It's going to see whether the person who's wearing the cell phone is close to an area which is designated as a place in their home, or if they're outside, and therefore it can track them where they are. If they're at home, their location is known. If it's not, a GPS is activated. If there is a noise and there is the motion detector that falls above a different threshold, it can detect that this person just had a fall and where they are, and then it could call for help. The next slide talks about another set of devices which are actually general as well. However, they're also used for medical applications. One of them is Google Glass. So Google Glass is reported to be used by doctors and physicians for helping them record data. So the doctor is wearing it, and while he's seeing the patient, instead of making notes, he's talking, and the data is getting recorded. During the same thing is being done in recording of events in surgeries, as well as during the consultation. As you can imagine, while that is taking place, there could be a backup group that could give more input to the doctor, or data can be used for recording or future use. Apple Watch, on the other hand, which I'm sure you've heard of, it can easily, with some applications, monitor physical activity and your heart rate, and also makes recommendations for better health. You know, you should move more or so on and so forth. Similarly, you may have heard of Fitbit that monitors physical activity, weight, altitude, heart rate, and so forth. Next slide, please. Yes. Okay, which would you like me to describe again? Oh, the illustration on the right is the Google Glass, right? Yeah, it's the Google Glass. So it's it's basically like a glasses you're wearing. It has a camera. It's taking the data. It's recording everything, and it could be broadcast to a central node. You're welcome. Okay. All right. Now we just went over wearable devices, and now we're going over surgically implanted devices. Next slide, please. Surgically implanted devices monitor vital functions, and they take immediate corrective actions and communicate with outside professionals. They can do all of that. Examples: pacemaker, neural implants, blood pressure devices. In the next slide, we start with pacemaker, which has been around for a long time, since the 50s. 3 million patients worldwide use this. Monitors heart rhythms and provides electrical shocks to assist the heart. And the illustration you have on the right is exactly an example of that made by Medtronic. Next slide, please. Next example is surgically implanted device for neural implants. Here you have micro electrodes that are implanted either on brain or spinal area. It was first implanted around 2000. And it is meant to assist with medical functions in the brain in terms of movement, memory, good for treatment of disease such as Parkinson's. Currently, two types are commercially available, made by Medtronic. One is at spinal cord stimulation for chronic pain, and the other one is deep brain therapy for Parkinson and other movement disorders. Next slide, please. Another example of surgically implanted devices is the blood pressure monitor. This is very recent. In 2014, developed in Stanford. It is implanted along veins under skin or in head. It does real-time blood pressure monitoring, and in fact, it's designed to be more than just blood pressure monitoring. It is intended to do more things like touch, sense of touch for skin, for prosthetic devices in the future. So this is something which is on the newer side. Now, next slide. Now we're going to move into non-invasive devices. This is where my team is working on. So we like to look at devices, non-invasive devices that are introduced into the body non-invasively by methods of injection, inhalation, ingestion, or other methods, but not in a non-invasive fashion. Because of this, because such methods of introduction require small size, this type of technology lends itself to nanotechnology, and that's where my team comes in, because we've been concentrating on nanotechnology in most recent years. Next slide. Okay, so that I can talk about this, first, it's necessary to give a little bit of introduction to what nanotechnology is and then give different types of non-invasive nanomedical devices that can be designed in this category. Next slide, please. So nano devices, and so this would be great for the students who are sitting here. So as you know, what does nano mean? What level, how many meters is nanometer? How big is nanometer? Right, 10 to the minus 9. Okay, so, good. Okay, so nano devices, or actually in literature, nano devices, while it's hoped to be built at 10 to the minus 9, but a lot of devices in the 10 to the minus 6 category are still referred to as nano devices. In fact, the term nanobot, which means nanorobot, currently is at the level of micro-scale integration. So again, micro is 10 to the minus 6, and nano is 10 to the minus 9. So with this technology, this small, there is so much opportunity in terms of making advancements in computing. Several nano computing methodologies are being investigated. One of them is DNA computing. How can you just use a DNA for computation? Spin waves is a work I did when I was at UCLA. I still continue some of that collaboration, which is basically computing based on a spin of an electron. So it's atomic scale computation. Another type of nano computing is quantum computing. Another type is molecular computing. There are lots of interesting applications with molecular computing. And in fact, if you can really figure out how to do things at molecular level, a lot of the things that I'm talking about now could be solved much, much better. Each one of these technologies has its pros and cons, and we don't have one which does everything. There are lots of challenges with nanoscale, and computations could be completely different. As you know, once you go down to nanoscale, and when things become so small, things don't work the way we're used to seeing them work. You're getting quantum effects, you get quantum properties, and everything looks different. Next slide, please. So basically you've got electrons that naturally are spinning, okay? So if you apply magnetic force to them, so then they're spinning, they align, they persist. So when they persist, they basically generate a wave. It has a dominoes effect. So one electron affects the other electron. So therefore what you're doing is that you're generating a wave. Coherent wave. So this wave is called spin wave. And spin wave has a relatively small attenuation. But the attenuation is good enough for computation that we want to do in nanoscale. Attenuation is in micron scale. So we've looked at designs where we're doing spin wave computing for nanoscale, and then once we do computation beyond that, then we can switch to regular computing at microscale. The good thing about spin wave computation is that you're doing computations now by passing information by waves instead of passing information by electrons. So since you're not passing charge, amount of heat dissipation, it's not really an issue. And in fact, this was, was considered, a major breakthrough when we started working on this. And that was because a lot of nano computing architectures have the heat problem. and they can't function properly in room temperature because of the huge heat dissipation. But with spin wave, because that's a different type of computation, that's not an issue. And from a computer science point of view, I love computing on spin waves because it takes us to a different level. You don't necessarily need to do things digitally anymore, and we can do computations based on waves. In some ways, it's like I always say that if years ago we had taken the analog path as opposed to the digital path, we could have done things so much better in certain ways. But the problem was analog was bigger, bulkier, and digital smaller, and we were able to do a lot of nice things. So I think this is a technology that actually has potential for coming and applying a lot of the analog technique, but it's yet very small. Okay, next slide, please. Okay. So now I want to go into types of non-invasive nanomedical devices. Next slide. Okay, so the types, I think actually you should go back to the previous one. Okay, so the types of non-invasive nanomedical devices, the three types, organic, inorganic, and hybrid. I'm going to start with organic. Next slide, please. Organic non-invasive devices, there are two main subsets. One are those which are based on bacteria, and the other one are based on DNA, molecular assembly, and function. And they're kind of more theoretical. Advantages of having organic devices is that when you want to fabricate them, they're self-assembly, and they're likely to be biocompatible by default because they're organic. Disadvantage of them is that, well, they're a little bit too natural. You have limited feedback. There are issues with how do you control them? How do you make them function in a particular way other than the way it is intended to be used? So in the next slide, I'm going to talk about what are inorganic devices. Inorganic devices, on the other hand, are things we're trying to build at USC. These are electronic devices that go through standard fabrication process and they're cut into very small pieces. We're hoping to get the advantages that it's intended to have, such as getting full feedback from these devices, being able to communicate with them even at nanoscale, control them, have them function in specific ways. The disadvantage of them, on the other hand, is that they're currently at larger size and it's very difficult to get them very small. And also, because they're electronic, there are biocompatibility issues. Next slide. So naturally, just like everything else, hybrid model plays a role here. Hybrid is a combination of an organic and inorganic devices. If you combine both of them, maybe we could get advantages of both. We could get biocompatibility, full communication, but then all of that will come as a cost. The design will be complicated, and there are going to be manufacturing challenges. Next slide. I'm going to talk about some of the device challenges, and then I'm just going to give you an example. Device challenges. Device challenges for this, the very first thing about them is that, as I was telling you, once you go to real nanoscale size, you have things that are subjected to quantum effects. Everything is different. Computing completely looks different. And there are several methods under the way, some of which I just briefly talked about, like spin wave. The other thing is that suppose you make them and you fabricate them on a chip and you bring them to that small level of manufacturing, somehow you need to slice them so that you could insert them in the body. Right now there are a lot of challenges in terms of how do you dice these chips. People are even talking about dicing them before you grind them, using sacrificial layers. So we're looking at some of this and we'll talk about them. Next slide, please. Another device challenge we have at nanoscale is power, especially if you want to have it for body. You want to make sure that the power that you use is reliable, is consistent, doesn't interfere with other devices in the body, right? If we inject a whole bunch of nanorobots in the body and we're communicating with them, we don't want them to start interfering with an implant. Must not interfere with other network communications. Size and rechargeability of them is important. The slide I have on the right is a powerless, it's a wireless power. Which, again, it's included in our book, which is coming up in Chapter 7. So we're talking about different wireless power technologies that are there. One of the challenges in designing those is the fact that they require a close range. So you can recharge them, but it's within a short range. So there are challenges in, like, how do you make it at a wider range and so forth. Next slide. So, like I said, all of these technologies, one of the important things about them is that how do you move them? So suppose I inject them into the body and I want to be able to move them. With organic devices, like we said, they're very passive and you have limited control ability. So with passive movement, you would be relying on having them pass through natural blood flow. For example, injecting them into bloodstream, they flow into bloodstream, they go through the heart, and so forth. Passive movement will have little or no control and may not require specific device area or power source for movement. Individual motors is when you have advanced control by device, you'll be able to maneuver each one of these devices. And then we have something that we're working on, and that's group movement. And other people have looked at this too. So I'm going to be talking about them when I go through examples, but basically means if I've got a group of nanobots in the body, instead of moving them one at a time, I can move a group of them. So like I could move a group of them, go through where someone may have cancer, and have them work specifically in that area, which makes it actually very attractive because targeted drug delivery and treatment is very, very important. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So if you're using a type of device which has passive control, then and if it's injected through the blood, then it's flowing with the blood. But not everything is should be like that. So therefore, we're going to talk about devices that are not necessarily going to flow through the blood. Yeah. Right, exactly. Not the ones that are stationary. Very good point. Actually, I should have said that. So with the non-invasively introduced devices, they're generally not stationary. They're moving. That's true. Okay. Next one. So let's look at device examples for this, so it kind of like puts them into perspective. Next slide, please. Okay, so examples of nanoscale medical devices, we've grabbed four examples to show you. One is E. coli. The other one is Biohybrid Janus Motors. Another one is MicroGrabber. And the last one is Magnetoelectric Nanoparticles. And towards the end, we'll talk to you about some of the work we're doing. Although it's in patent process, so I'll just be able to speak very lightly about it. Next. Okay, so E. coli used to deliver genes and DNA for gene therapy and vaccination. Okay, so you're basically talking about a bacteria introduced by ingestion. Okay, so somebody takes it in. You have passing movement control. There's no way you can specifically say where to go or what to do. Once it reaches the cells, it's taken into host cell with vacuoles and escapes into cytosol. So students who are doing AP biology or cellular biology, I'm sure this sounds recent. It's effective in preclinical trials. Doesn't appear to deliver, however, traditional anti-cancer drugs. On the next slide, however, yes. No, it doesn't. Exactly. It just does its thing. So very recently, in fact, this in 2015, we had some new results which have come up in this area. And the source of the result is shown below. So this is Biohybrid Janus Motors. So what it is that they basically took these polystrain Janus particles and they capped it with metal on one side. And the metal side is binded to the E. coli bacteria. So remember, E. coli is naturally moving, right? So the metal side attaches to this E. coli, so the E. coli becomes the motor, the natural motor. And then this metal, polystyrene, on the other side, polystyrene side, is used to attach a drug. Okay. So basically, you've taken something which is completely organic, you made an inorganic device, which has a property that attaches to this. This is going to move, and it's also taking cancer medicine with it to the cells. Okay. So this is very new, introduced through various methods. And then on top of that, it has one more property that I'll talk about. Yes. Exactly. So you're right in a sense that each one of these E. coli, there's so much medicine it can take. It's not that much. But the idea is that you're going to have millions of them that are carrying them and not just a small amount. And how effective is going to be and how often you're going to do this so that there is enough treatment that is carried, that's something that needs to be studied. Okay. But everything that you said is actually true. And this field is very new, and we're just trying to come up with the ways that we could make it work. In fact, in the future slides that I'm going to get through, I'm going to talk about other techniques that is not going to be restricted to only this path. Okay, what if you want to access other areas of the body? What if you want to have more control? However, I have to say that because they have metal capped this polystyrene particle and attached it to E. coli, then they can, in a group way, move them magnetically. Now, so as were before, E. coli you could not move magnetically, right? So at least now by making a hybrid model, you got some kind of control over the whole thing. Okay. So this is not yet tested in and it's very, very new. It's one of the latest results, yes. Right, so they are very, very small and you can't exactly count them. You're right. And there is also this problem with them that when you look at a device or a technique like this, you say, what if all this cancer medicine is going to too many cells and it's even going to a cell which is good, right? So I'm going to talk about some other techniques which is going to be working specifically to go to cancer cells and not go to healthy cells. I believe so. Yes, Mike? Yeah. They is asking about different metals that are used for making the connection. And in fact, in terms of the receptors that you talked about, although do we have the PNL slide? We don't have the PNL, but yes, there is another hybrid model that outside of it has receptors. So it is a hybrid model in a sense that they put organic receptors outside this carrier and the receptors is attracted to cancerous cells. But the problem with that again is that it's not like you can control it that much. It naturally gets attracted. So, there's always pros and cons. But that's a very good point. We're actually debating whether or not to include that today, and we thought this would be a better example because it's a little bit newer. Yes. Okay, next slide. Mike.
Quiet, please.
Okay, and the next example is a micro-grabber. Okay, so this is not drug delivery. Okay, this is for doing biopsy. So there are this small micro scale size grabbers. They will call them micro robots because they're actually really on the very large range of micro robots. And they're inserted into body. They're introduced manually. And they go in and they take samples, and then when they come out, they check to see if the samples that they got are cancerous or not. So this was used to perform colon biopsies on pigs in 2009. So recovery methods include searching the stool or magnet-aided manual recovery. Not a very interesting or an attractive application, but it's a start because we're trying to see different ways we can take electronic or hybridly controlled nanorobots or microrobots so we can do a lot of the things that are related to cancer in a non-invasive fashion. Next slide. I will take it after this. Yeah. Okay. So another example that I want to give, and after this we can take a break because then we'll come to a point where I've reviewed this different type of devices, is a magneto-electric nanoparticle. Okay. So basically, this is actually what I consider to be a very interesting and important discovery. Okay, so cells, when they're healthy versus cells when they're cancerous, they have different properties and they have different level of strength. So what can be done in making sure that you take cancer medicine only to cancerous cells and not healthy cells What is done is that you take very small electrical nanoscale particles and you put medicine on them. So they have coating of medicine. Now, then what you do is that you give them enough magnetic force, just enough, so that it can penetrate into a cancerous cell, but it's not big enough for it to go into a healthy cell. So therefore, we consider this a huge discovery or invention, because now you will technically be able to, if someone has cancer, instead of going through chemotherapy and killing all the good cells along with it, you would take this method and medicine only goes to the cancerous cells and not the healthy ones. Okay, so once the delivery is done, how do you basically get rid of the devices? Okay, so to answer that question is that I know that this is being tested now in animals. It hasn't been tested on humans. I'm right, correct? It's been tested on animals. I don't exactly know how they get rid of the particles yet, but I do know that the results have shown to be really great. In fact, they did on some pigs, and they recovered, and they got rid of their cancer, which was really impressive. So the figure that you have there, it shows these small nanoparticles, and as you can see, they're flowing around a regular cell. That's the left one, right? But because this cell is healthy and because I don't give it too much force, it cannot penetrate. But it goes through that, it gets penetrated, and as soon as it penetrates, then the drug is released. But that's a good question. So, you know, maybe we could talk about it, and then maybe I could look it up and get back to you about, like, effects of how they get rid of it. Yes. Okay, so with this one, this is a little bit different than the one which was bacteria and the solution. Okay, so these are just like, look at it as a bunch of small metals, right? Small metals, balls, right? And they're just nanoscale, right? And they're coated with medicine. Exactly, yeah. So, you know, I perhaps confuse you in a sense that I started with E. coli, but E. coli was my first example. I was saying, well, look at E. coli. And by the way, with E. coli, it's not necessarily cure cancer. It has more of a preventive, it's more of a preventive method. It works more on DNA. And then there was the hybrid and so on and so forth. And I need to go to next slide and stop slide. How did the pig have cancer? I don't know. I yeah. Yeah. I think they're probably pigs. I really don't know how they select the pigs, but probably the pigs had cancer. Actually, the paper, as far as I remember, it was the studies were concentrated on a specific type of cancer, such as ovarian cancer. Pardon me? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Okay, so I think at this time, I'll take the break, and then when we come back, I will talk about swarm behavior, which is some kind of a combination but a different type of making them, and that's something that our group is working on. And then we can move on to the network integration and talk about ethical and legal and security issues associated with this. Okay, so before we took the break, we said that we're talking about body networks and that it was a network of different kind of computing devices that are located close or inside the body. And then we said that in this talk we classified them into three groups. We said first group was the wearable group. The second group was the surgically implanted ones. And then the third one that we started talking about was non-invasive nanomedical devices. We talked about some of the challenges with nanotechnology, nanocomputing, and then we started talking about some examples of such devices. Generally speaking, we said there are three categories. One is organic, the other one is inorganic, and the other one was hybrid. With organic, we gave the example of E. coli. For inorganic, we gave the MEM devices, magno electro nano devices. We gave the micro grabber devices, and there were the hybrid, where, for example, you had the metal cupped particles attached to E. coli. And they all had their advantages and disadvantages. But if we wanted to make something which was ideal, we wanted to be something which is nanoscale. We wanted to have control. We want us to be able to navigate it and therefore take it to wherever it is we want to take it, to like certain cells that are cancerous, that are at different locations. If it was up to us, we want them to be able to communicate to them and do diagnostic and send them into different areas and have them do certain tasks, do destruction of cells, do make changes to cells if you could. So these are all on our wish list. And these are the goals that are there in making these devices. So we're taking these examples. We have a project we're working on today, currently in my team. And that works based on the concept of swarm behavior. So let me go through this work. With just giving you a little bit of information, but unfortunately I can't give you details because we're trying to get this patented. But basically the concept is that we want to move, we're making these nanoscale devices. They're not exactly nano, but they're technically speaking called nano because they're close to nanoscale range. They're a group of them. They work as a swarm. In other words, we get a group of them and we get a group of them work in a certain pattern. So we make something which has a bigger power or bigger reconfigurability using very small components. Okay? So it's as though you take millions of small particles and you form them in a certain way and they make it some other kind of device. They can this way cover a bigger area, more concentration. They work together to accomplish tasks. And the reason we're able to do this is that because we're basically making these nano devices, which are not so nano, but they're at least in micro scale. And they have sensors. And they have sensors and they transmit information from inside the body to a computer which sits on the desktop. We get this data collectively. We do all of the computation and all of the processing outside so that they don't have to do anything inside. So we basically use the power of massive number of these small components who just give us a small amount of information in doing complex things outside. One of its applications that we're aiming for is actually imaging for diagnosis. For example, for diagnosing cancer or problems with cells, going to areas which is difficult and it's hard to detect using the techniques which is there, so that it could take place or it could help in diagnosis of things that are rate of false detection is high, right? And you don't have to operate because it's non-invasive. So these are some of the research that we're doing. They are inorganic devices. And I said the two applications of it is drug delivery and nanoscale. Mike Solisinger, one of my assistants, leads that project. He's sitting here. Other members of my group that I've listed here, Umang Sharma and Harsh Holadad, are part of this project as well. So given the fact that we said you could have network of medical devices which are wearable, are physically and surgically implanted or introduced non-invasively, okay, the important key issue is how do we get them to talk to each other and communicate? And this is where the network integration comes in. In fact, for us in computer engineers, this is probably the easiest part of the whole puzzle because we're so advanced in computer networking, which this part of it is actually quite simple. I think the challenges are when you are an electrical engineer and you want to really understand medicine and you don't have much background. But in my opinion, and when I go around and give talks and talk to people, I give my lectures in my classes, and the students that I'm training now in USC, my message to them is that if you want to solve this problem, you have to do interdisciplinary work and training. In fact, at USC, I'm in process of making a new course, and this is strongly encouraged and being supported by the university administration, where we bring in freshmen. So from the first year of their freshman studies, we introduce them to these problems so that the curriculum that they take, it's a combination of biology, chemistry, math, engineering, physics, so that by the time they get to higher levels, they have better understanding and are able to collaborate with people who may specialize in some other fields. Yeah, it's happened. Okay, all right. So like I said, now we're moving to network integration. So we're talking about integration of all device types that we talked about into a single body network. So this, to integrate it, then we need to go through the type of networks that are currently proposed to do things like that. There are basically two types, centralized networks and decentralized network. And we're going to give two examples, the NOMI network and the Markov process based network, both of which are featured in my book that is coming up. Okay, so in a centralized network, a centralized node makes all the decisions. Centralized node controls access. It compensates for actions of one variable that affect others. It's, you know, whatever that may be, whether it's for energy optimization or other things as we're going to talk about a little bit. And in a decentralized work, you have a, you know, fully connected network of elements that they work not under the control of a single node, but in a distributed fashion. And we'll talk about how that is done too. However, that doesn't mean that as a decentralized network, there may still be a representative which connects to the rest of the networks. So NOMI example is centralized. You know, you have a glucose sensor, GPS, insulin pump, motion, blood pressure sensor, body temperature sensor. They're all connected to this. And this central node may actually just be your cell phone that monitors physical activity, measures energy usage based on it, and it measures energy and it does optimization. We have this as one of the examples in our book. Another example is that when you have something which is completely distributed, you know, so in this example that we have, every node, it's kind of got its table lookup. So every node senses what everybody else is doing. And then based on the pre-determined set of actions, it looks at the parameters that it receives and makes a decision individually about what to do next. Again, these concepts are not really new, right? When it comes to networking, we're really very mature in this area. What's new about this is that in our work, we are now integrating one additional level to this whole network. And this is why we call it body network as opposed to body area network. And that's the swarm of the elements that we have inside. So in other words, for the first time, we're doing computations externally just by sensing where these components are going and what they're sensing. Very, very small amount of information that we receive, but because we receive millions of them, they make sense and they produce something which is meaningful if they are processed and we use very smart algorithms to make meaning out of them. So, now having talked about technical aspects of this, I think it's important to talk about some legal, ethical, and security issues of this technology. Okay, so as you know, this is a relatively a very new field as applied to medicine. A lot of challenges exist. We'll talk about three major issues. Legal, within legal, we talk about privacy, intellectual property. Then next, we talk about some ethical aspects. And then at the end, we'll talk about security and we conclude our talk. Okay. So privacy on nanoscale is when I think about it, I think it's scary. One of the main pillars of criminal law in this country is expectation of privacy, right? Every individual has an expectation of privacy, and the government cannot invade what you have a reasonable expectation of privacy unless they have a search warrant, right? But what happens when you have a technology that takes away whatever expectation of privacy anybody could have? So with your professor, we were having a discussion over the break. He was telling me, I like to have a technology where I know where my students go home, what's going on with them, right? So he wants to. So with nanotechnology, I could just give you a handshake and say it was nice meeting you. And not that I intend to do it, even if I have the technology, but I could go home and I've basically given you millions of sensors, and I can watch everything that you do at home, right? It's scary, but it is there, and it's not very far from happening. So are we ready as a society to have this technology? It doesn't go into blood. They're just particles. They're nanoscale particles which have imaging capabilities, and they're invisible. You can't see them. Shake hands. It could be. I could put it here. It's a very, very scary technology, right? And it's not whether we're ready for it or not. Once it's there and people have it, it's going to be used. Even if you have the laws that we have, and even though the government cannot invade your privacy unless there is a warrant for it, okay? But if everybody can see what everybody is doing and they get broadcast everywhere, it's very hard to control. Exactly. Well, okay. Yes, that's true. But right now, right, that's true. But actually, you're safe if the police does that to you. Because even though there is a technology to do it, police cannot do that to you without having a warrant. Yeah, you could do it to the police, or your friend could do it to you, and then once it goes on a public domain, then the police legally can use it, right? So police can use something which is publicly available. So if somehow your data is publicly available, they can use it. But police, even though they have this technology, they can't use it on you, or else, even though they get the evidence, you could have them dismissed because it was not public, it was invasion of your privacy, right? Right? Just as you know, right? Police, right now we have surveillance technology, right? But if the police put surveillance at your home without a search warrant, even if they see you're doing some illegal acts, they can't do anything. I mean, they could start prosecuting you, but you can throw away all the evidence because it was not obtained properly, right? But so this is a very, very scary technology to me. I mean, we've seen some samples of this on internet, right? People post things, there are cameras everywhere, your whole life as soon as you leave home, it's recorded. But this goes to a different level. So this brings an important issue, requirements for future legislation, laws that could protect us against this. Are we going to regulate it? How are we going to regulate it? Well, for our stuff, with our things, we don't do the actual fabrication on campus. So we get outside contractors to do it. But you're right. I mean, these are all issues. And unfortunately, I can't go through too much of details of them right now, but maybe we can talk afterwards. Okay, so that's some of the things about privacy. There's also the intellectual property. In fact, some of the things that causes me to not say too much about some of these things. As you all know, there are generally four types of intellectual property: patents, copyright, trademark, trade secret. You're probably familiar with them. It's very impressed to know that one of the distinguished members of this club is the inventor of solar panels. So I do know that in the audience we have a lot of inventors and scientists who are familiar with these terms. Now, the thing about, there are lots of issues actually with patenting nanotechnology that is very unique to nano. And one of them is like the kind of classifications that they have over at USPTO for nanotechnology. For one, it's very new. And one of the major issues is that there are just not really that many examiners out there in the USPTO office who can evaluate the patent applications in nano. Oftentimes, there are things that are rejected or not put through because there is not a good understanding. Sometimes the problem is that there is a shortage of prior art. Sometimes there are problems because the examiner just has no way of finding out whether or not the claims that are made in this patent work correctly or not. So there's issues with that. So for those people who may be interested in looking at some of these issues with respect to nanotechnology and patenting, there are many, many things that need work. Even when you get to the technical aspects of it, being involved in patent prosecution and litigation myself, one of the things which is very important when you get when you apply for a patent is to be able to prove that what you have, it's non-obvious. Okay, so obviousness definition in patent law, it's a very challenging area. It's a lot more challenging than trying to argue anticipation, which is another criteria that is used. But one of the things that patent examiners do is that they say, well, if you just make a smaller version of a bigger thing, this is an obvious derivation of the other one, and therefore it doesn't really need a patent. Oh, well, the point is that in nanocomputing, when you bring something from microscale to nanoscale, it's a world of difference. And it's not just a small miniaturized version of that. Try to make it that level. So when you come up with a technology that its application and trying to get it patented, You have to basically go and argue with the patent office and say the patent laws that we have in terms of obviousness or subcategories actually are not really sufficient or applicable to this kind of technology. So in our chapter, in our book, we have, I think, one or two chapters that we talk about these issues and, you know, the challenges and, you know, maybe, you know, we just went through U.S., we went through patent reform. We're trying to work on that, and maybe these are some of the other areas that could be, one could look into. And there's always this other issue, such as, do you go for patent or do you go for trade secret? You know, patents, you get a patent because it's a contract between you and the government supported by U.S. Constitution. You say, I disclose something and you give me monopoly. For 20 years, I benefit from anyone using it, but I need to disclose it. With a lot of this technology, maybe it's not really a good option to get a patent, because you get monopoly for 20 years. But if you have a trade secret, and some people think that if I just keep it a secret and don't get a patent, there's no way to do reverse engineering. So there are all these reverse engineering aspects, disclosure requirements. Not necessarily patent is the way to do it.
Well, I'm saying that there is already much of this taking place in the treatment of these companies that have inhaled insulin, and they're fighting over this patent rights and the right to charge as much as they want and all of these things. And that's part of what you're talking about here on another scale. But I think one of the principles, I happen to be a lawyer, one of the principles that I've learned in law is, if you get something that works, somehow or other people will figure out how you get around the laws. And if you come up with something that cures somebody, then there are other forces that are going to come into effect, and they're going to find out the ways that you can evade these laws.
Okay, so next we're going to quickly touch about some ethical aspects of this. So how do we utilize network and non-invasive device advances while avoiding the negative implications inherent to the technology? Okay, so it's very important to make accurate representation of whatever it is that we're doing. Okay, all the way from when you're going and asking for funding to get funding for these projects, making sure that you're not promising something that is not there. You know, even in making a talk like this, not creating chaos. If information is inaccurate, it does create false perception, which is very important to avoid. A big component of all of this technology is the clinical trials. A lot of the things I talked about, the most that was done about them is that it's gone to the level of animal testing. So obviously they need to get to the next level to be tested on patients. It is very important to let people know what are the risks, what are the side effects. Some of you ask the questions, like, would the cell, the cancer cell gets destroyed? What happens after that? Does your body naturally get rid of it? Is there a residual effect? Are there side effects of, you know, there are all these studies that needs to be done. We might be able to move forward with some of this because we want to find out how to, you know, make devices that come close to it. But there may be a lot of other things that at the same time we need to look at. Some of the questions, some of the points that you raised. How was this? I mean, was this, how did the animals got the cancer to begin with? So, And also, as we go on, it is very important to set our priorities correctly as we develop these things. Right now, for example, with networks, medical devices that are used with your cell phones, they can be very helpful in third world countries where they don't have access to hospitals or doctors and they can't get to them closely. So maybe priorities in funding and allocation maybe should go to those areas first and then trying to go against Darwin's theory and making the unfit to survive. So there is a need to carefully balance access and a need requirement. Or also allocation of resources for treatment, real treatment versus enhancement needs. Okay. How much of it you should go to treatment or how much of it you should go for example, you want your skin to look younger. Okay. So there are all these issues. Measures need to be taken to eliminate device misuse, right? So to not use it like for what we just talked about, or to safely dispose these devices. I mean, there are just so many things that need to be studied and to be looked at. Okay. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is security. Again, this falls in one of those categories that in terms of a general networking, we're pretty mature in security, but we actually started looking into this and we find out there is still a lot of room to make improvements. So you want to make sure you have security on device, you have security during transmission, you have security once the data is stored, security in accessing data, and for that, you may want to use encryption and so forth. So let's put all of this in perspective and talk about some of the things that we're doing. So when we started looking at this, we realized that for body networks, once the data is transmitted, in other words, suppose you're wearing, a body network where you have a pacemaker, there is an activity monitor, you're wearing the blood pressure monitor, and all of that through the cell phone that you have is getting broadcast to your doctor, right? So, as soon as it's broadcast, the typical networking security protocols kicks in, right? So like HTTP protocols and all of that is in place. And so that's fine. But we find out that because these are new applications, no one has really thought about encrypting the data before it's being sent, right? So like with military applications, you would never do that, right? You would never send the data before it's encrypted. But in medical devices application, no one has done that. So actually we looked at it and, some of my graduate students picked it up immediately and, we started putting encryption algorithms. So that's one of the other projects that we're working on. But thank you. Yeah. They could create a heart attack. Yeah. So, it's sad, but I guess the good news is that, the good news about it is that these are easy problems to fix. No. I mean to make security so that's not there. It's easy. That's true. It is possible. It is possible. Well, I guess if somebody wanted to do a criminal act, right, they can turn off your pacemaker. They can do that. They can disable it. They can make it malfunction. They could make it so that it doesn't work anymore, or it actually does the opposite, or it gives you too much shocks, right? Anything, it's possible to do all of that remotely. They have to find you. Well, actually, if you are connected to a network, somebody could do that to you remotely. If your pacemaker is connected to a network and your doctor is monitoring it, and somebody hacks into that network, depending on like whether they're firewalls or their protection, if there's no protection, they can remotely do something to your pacemaker. But your pacemaker must have the capability of being adjusted remotely as well. You actually don't need a protective device. These are just the devices have to be modified, and more software has to be put on them, more levels of security, so what is a firewall? Basically, it's just one level of security, right? So if anybody wants to access this device, they have to pass certain security measures. There has to be keys. Nothing is 100%, right? Nowadays, I teach a computer science course, and it's just like such a big deal for the students. They come to the class and they say, I'm able to hack into this. I'm sitting there and I think that they can just, it's no problem for them to hack into the grading of the class. Because it's not a big deal, for them. They have hackers clubs, they have hackers conferences. So the more protection you put, the more protection you have, but then they always can come up with something counter to that.
Excuse me, it's 9 o'clock, and it's getting quite late, and we're supposed to be out of here already. So can we have a couple more questions
and
then let Professor wrap up, and then we can have some discussions before we leave?
One thing we know we will be seeing with this gee whiz technology that we've been seeing is that as it enters the legal arena through misuse of it, the law will be way behind the curve. It is now, always has been, and as this stuff comes online, it'll be quite a while before they begin to catch up.
I totally agree with you. Yes. Okay, so these are the concerns that you talked about. I talked about the fact that we're trying to do the device encryption. We just have no idea why no one had been doing it before. And here I've got my conclusion. All right, so again, much of this work, this research, it's in its early stages, holds much potential for future development. With things progressing in the right way, they can lead to a very affordable global healthcare. So maybe this will solve our healthcare issues to some degree. You could reach constant monitoring for healthcare, less frequent doctor visits, personalized medicine, and we feel in conjunction with our current hospital healthcare system, they can be a vital part of cost-effective patient care for our growing global population. And there are, the last word that I want to say, many, many challenges lie ahead, not only in engineering, but also in dealing with the legal and ethical aspects of this emerging technology. And with that, I would like to thank you so much for being here and being a great audience.